Potster Podcast, where politics, religion, and history collide, and it's not always polite. In college, I took an ethics course out of the philosophy department as one of my GECs, General Education Curriculum Requirements. One of the topics we covered in the course was abortion. We were tasked with reading the essay, A Defense of Abortion, by moral objectivist philosopher Judith Jarvis Thompson. In it, she provides an allegory that she believes will demonstrate the soundness of the pro-choice position on the abortion issue. Here's a small section of it. I propose, then, that we grant that a fetus is a person from the moment of conception. How does the argument go from here? Something like this, I take it. Every person has a right to life. So the fetus has a right to life. No doubt the mother has a right to decide what shall happen in and to her body. Everyone would grant that. But surely a person's right to life is stronger and more stringent than the mother's right to decide what happens in and to her body, and so outweighs it. So the fetus may not be killed, and abortion may not be performed. It sounds plausible, but now let me ask you to imagine this. You wake up in the morning and find yourself back to back in bed with an unconscious violinist, a famous unconscious violinist. He has been found to have a fatal kidney ailment, and the Society of Music Lovers has canvassed all the available medical records and found that you alone have the right blood type to help. They have therefore kidnapped you, and last night the violinist's circulatory system was plugged into yours, so that your kidneys can be used to extract poisons from his blood as well as your own. The director of the hospital now tells you, "Look, we're sorry the Society of Music Lovers did this to you. We would have never permitted it if we had known, but still they did it, and the violinist is now plugged into you. To unplug you would be to kill him. But never mind, it's only for 9 months. By then he will recover from his ailment and can safely be unplugged from you. Is it morally incumbent on you to accede to the situation? No doubt it would be very nice of you if you did, a great kindness. But do you have to accede to it? What if it were not 9 months but 9 years, or longer still? What if the director of the hospital says, tough luck, I agree, but now you've got to stay in bed with the violinist plugged into you for the rest of your life? Because remember this, all persons have a right to life, and violinists are persons. Granted, you have a right to decide what happens in and to your body, but a person's right to life outweighs your right to decide what happens in and to your body. So you cannot ever be unplugged from him. I imagine you regard this as outrageous, which suggests that something really is wrong with that plausible-sounding argument I mentioned a moment ago. There's more to this essay, and it's definitely worth reading. The famous violinist is an allegory that illustrates pregnancy resulting from rape, but elements can be extrapolated to symbolize unwanted pregnancy and forcing women to endure it unwillingly. But me at 20 years old got something completely different out of it than what Thompson intended. Just as the hypothetical self in the allegory didn't ask to be hooked up to the violinist didn't ask to be in this situation. But if the two are unplugged, the violinist would lose his life. It was a bad situation, but it didn't sit well with me for the violinist to die because the hypothetical self didn't want to be inconvenienced. But that probably shows I'm no objectivist. I am your host, Jay Poole. Abortion is a polarizing issue in the United States, and it has been for several decades. It is often portrayed as being a very simple issue on both the pro-life and pro-choice sides. You're either for abortion rights or against them, and each side has its slanted language and imagery to refer to the issue, themselves and the other side, as if the issue is easy and simple. The fact is that abortion in the United States has a very complicated history. Abortion is also tied into a number of other issues: healthcare, adoption, social services, and America's safety net. Abortion is tied closely to identity, religion, gender, and race. Abortion is not easy and simple. And all too often, we do not give the abortion issue the thoughtful and careful deliberation and treatment it deserves. If you feel strongly about abortion, and your views neatly fit into an extreme pro-life or pro-choice side, you will surely not be happy about some of the things I'll say in the next two episodes. I aim for this to be about truth-telling, and when the truth sees the light of day, it sometimes stings. But hopefully this will be an opportunity to consider your positions carefully. I've spent close to 20 years thinking this through from a number of angles. I do not pretend to have all the answers. I sure don't. But I hope that at least some of what I have to share will resonate with you, or at least make you feel and ponder. This topic will be divided into two episodes. Part one will be about the history of abortion as a controversial issue, concentrating primarily on the period of time before the 1973 Roe v. Wade U.S. Supreme Court decision. In part two, I will discuss the post-Roe abortion controversy and solutions that should bring pro-life and pro-choice people together. The key question we will discuss in part two is this. Does the pro-life movement truly want to save the lives of the unborn? I bring up this question here in part one because I want you to think through this question both during this episode and the next. Both part one and part two reflect nearly two decades of exploring the abortion issue as a professor, as an independent political observer, and as a woman of faith. At the outset, I believe I should lay all my cards out on the table. I should give you my actual view first and get into how I got there. Even though in high school I knew of abortion, I did not begin formulating a view on it until college. When I was in my late teens, early 20s, the best way I could describe my view at that point was pro-life with reservations. I was very much against abortion at the time. My thought was pretty simple. The child doesn't have a choice. I remember watching an interview with Jesse Jackson during the Bush v. Gore saga of 2000, the first time I voted, by the way. And he mentioned in passing about reproductive rights and women being able to choose what they should do with their bodies. And I thought to myself, he's supposed to be a pastor. How can he support abortion rights? He's totally sold out to politics. But even though I was strongly pro-life, I could never see myself joining the pro-life movement. Even then, I was wary of the movement because I knew that so many people who were part of the movement were also against funding social services, public assistance, and other programs that would help the very people who would be born if abortion were not an option. Many of them were also against sex education and contraception, which would prevent many women from being in the position to consider abortion. It seemed that the pro-life position was not actually pro-life, but just anti-abortion. Even then, I felt that life begins at conception, but does not end at birth. Over time, I got to know people who have had abortions. The decision came about for many reasons, feeling they were too young or immature to raise a child, lack of support from family or the child's father, difficult financial circumstances, sexual assault. Some felt it was the best option for them at the time. Others felt regret at the choice. But what tied these women together was that abortion was a choice they took in a desperate situation. And as I gained more knowledge and life experience, I began thinking about the issue a bit differently. I'm a woman who lives with a condition that makes it very difficult to have children. Given that, of course, on one hand, one would say being able to have kids isn't something to be taken for granted. I can see that very clearly from my position. But on the other hand, being in the same position, reproductive matters are medical and personal matters that should be the domain of the woman involved and her doctor. The fact of the matter is, every woman's situation is different. And pregnancy and parenting is hard. Let me be clear. Being hard does not equal not worth doing. But neither pregnancy nor parenting should be taken lightly. Pregnancy puts a major strain on the woman's body and can lead to many health complications, including gestational diabetes and preeclampsia, a condition characterized by abrupt hypertension, swelling, and other symptoms, which can be deadly. Women who are required to be on certain medications for physical or mental health may have to discontinue their medications during pregnancy, and this can potentially lead to disastrous results. And as discussed in episode 4, Even with the medical advances of the present age, women still can and do die in childbirth. The United States has some of the highest rates of maternal mortality in the Western world. In parenting, most parents will swear by the fact that your life changes when you have a child. Some couples find it brings them closer together. Many couples find having a child adds additional strain, and some break up or divorce. I know of several couples who have split up or divorced shortly after having a child. There are people who are not able to provide for a child due to a lack of stability in lifestyle or finances, or are not in a proper place mentally for a child. Now, some will say, if people aren't ready to handle pregnancy or childbirth, don't have sex. Show personal responsibility for your actions. Or, there are other options. What about adoption? I'll delve further into these arguments in part 2, but I will say this to start out with. Bringing another life into this world as punishment for what some may consider bad choices is a pretty horrible idea. And behind the personal responsibility argument is the idea that an anti-abortion position is less about the sanctity of life and more about being punitive. And while it's good to be responsible, using the idea of personal responsibility as a hammer to condemn women who have made mistakes or have made unwise decisions, or women who are not clairvoyant and did not know their circumstances would change, and then add additional difficulties to what is already a tough situation, is the very opposite of what Jesus taught. Let he who was without sin cast the first stone. The fact of the matter is that very few women use abortion as frontline birth control and often turn to it as a last resort, not an easy get-out-of-jail-free card. As a society, we need to learn to trust women, including that women are capable of making decisions for themselves and their families, even if it's not necessarily the decision you would make. That is why, over time, I shifted from a pro-life position, with reservations, to being politically pro-choice. But you're a Christian, Jay. How can you be a Christian but not against abortion? Isn't abortion murder? Do I believe the unborn is a life? Yes. We can look at science and see it's not simply a clump of cells. At 3 weeks, the embryo has its own distinct DNA. The heart beats at 5 weeks. Facial features begin to form at 6 weeks. It becomes a fetus at 10 weeks, and its vital organs begin to function. And that's all just in the first trimester of pregnancy. But believe it or not, the Bible does not directly address abortion. Arguments are made against abortion using the Bible, most often using these passages. Before I formed you in the womb, I knew you, and before you were born, I consecrated you. Jeremiah 1:5. For you formed my inward parts. You knitted me together in my mother's womb. I praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works. My soul knows it very well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was being made in secret, intricately woven in the depths of the earth. Your eyes saw my unformed substance. In your book were written, every one of them, the days that were formed for me, when as yet there were none of them. Psalm 139:13 through 16. While both passages are illustrations as to how the prophet Jeremiah and King David, respectively, were called by God, as he always had a plan for them, neither are specific to abortion or that the life of the unborn is equal to or superior to those who have already been born. To use these passages to draw a solid line in the sand regarding the abortion issue is taking them completely out of context. In Genesis 2:7, the Bible says, "And the Lord God formed man of the dust of the ground, and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living soul." Other passages allude to breath as the beginning of life, not conception. Abortion most definitely occurred during the biblical period, so the lack of definitive statement regarding abortion, while the Bible does speak to infanticide, is not because we as a society are worse now than societies of the past regarding this practice. I do believe that people with a heart for Christ can disagree on when life begins or on abortion as a political issue. The Bible does not denounce abortion the way it denounces greed, lack of compassion, and neglect of the poor and the oppressed. I've read a number of works from Christians, including clergy, who oppose abortion, but none provide solid biblical foundation for abortion as murder, or the primacy of abortion as a specific kind of evil that justifies disregarding all other political and social issues. While I do believe the fetus is a life, murder is the unlawful premeditated killing of one human being by another. For the time being, abortion is legal, but more than that, the use of the term murder by pro-life advocates indicates malice, essentially that women seeking abortions are more than happy to kill their unborn babies. It assumes evil intent on the behalf of women in situations where abortion is chosen. It's easy to demonize, it's harder to understand. But seeking to understand is an act of love. It's a way we can love our neighbor as ourselves. As mentioned earlier, abortion is not new. It was not even new at the time of the landmark Roe v. Wade decision. Abortion has had a long history, as it has always been performed in various societies, even during ancient times. Abortions occurred for similar reasons they occur in modern times. The pregnant woman may be unmarried, or the baby's father is not her husband. She may not be in a position to raise a child, either mentally or logistically. The child's father may have abandoned the mother, or the pregnancy may be a result of rape. Abortion gave women a choice over their bodies and lives in societies where they otherwise had few choices. In America's colonial period, abortion was permitted before quickening, in other words, the point in time the fetus could be felt moving. But abortions performed after quickening, while generally frowned upon and in many cases considered illegal, were very difficult to prove in a court of law. Black women in slavery, though, were not permitted to abort at all. The reason being obvious, that these women and any children they bore were considered the property of the slave owner, and slave owners had a vested interest in enslaved women having as many offspring, or future slaves, as possible. At the same time, enslaved women did secretly have abortions and even committed infanticide in some cases. Because some of the pregnancies were as a result of rape by slave owners and white overseers, and because, regardless of how the pregnancies came to be, many enslaved women did not want their children to live the harsh, abusive lives in bondage they had lived. By the 1880s, the states had instituted various bans on abortion for all women, with the exception of therapeutic use, the meaning of which varied depending on the medical professional and the legal system. Why did this shift occur? For one thing, the American Medical Association was pushing for doctors, who were mostly men, to have the exclusive right to practice medicine. This meant pushing out midwives, apothecaries, and homeopaths, who were mostly women. The AMA pressured state governments to criminalize abortion practices, which were generally carried out at the time by midwives rather than doctors. Also, abortion was criminalized because of nativist pressures on government. Nativism was a movement popular during the late 1800s and early 1900s that advocated the protection of the interests of native-born white Americans over those of immigrants. During this time, primarily Catholic immigrants from countries such as Ireland, Germany, and Italy were viewed by a number of native-born Americans as a threat to the cultural values of white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. Nativists were concerned with immigrant birth rates outpacing birth rates of native-born whites, whose birth rates were declining as many individuals and families were moving to cities, where it was less practical to have lots of children. Both reasons were embodied in Dr. Horatio Storer, a Boston surgeon that was the leading advocate for abortion criminalization during this time. In his book, Why Not? A Book for Every Woman, He argues that abortion should be made illegal for a woman's health and safety, as well as for moral reasons. He found it appalling that at the time, married white Protestant women were the most likely group of women to seek abortions. But he also states, women's mind is prone to depression and, indeed, to temporary derangement. During the state of gestation, the woman is therefore liable to thoughts, convictions even, that at other times she would turn from in disgust and dismay, and in this fact, we find her most valid excuse for the crime. He also states, all the fruitfulness of the present generation can hardly fill in the gaps of our population. Then goes on to say, shall they be filled by our own children or those of aliens? This is a question that our own women must answer. Upon their loins depends the future destiny of the nation. Storer's views were complex and fueled by beliefs that the fetus was a life, abortion was immoral, that women weren't capable of making their own decisions regarding their pregnancies, and that white American Protestant women, in particular, owed it to society to birth more children so the country wouldn't be taken over by Catholic immigrants. But the legal restrictions that Storer supported and were enacted in some form in all states did not stop abortion. Statistics during this period are unreliable, as it is just about impossible to determine the prevalence of an illegal procedure. But prior to 1973, illegal abortions are estimated at upwards of 1.2 million per year. Middle and upper class white women had access to abortions through private doctors, which were still illegal but were performed under safe conditions. But not all women had this type of access. Women of color and poor women almost never had this type of access and had to resort to back alley abortions, or in other words, abortions by untrained providers in unsanitary conditions. This led to many injuries and deaths. Abortion was listed as the cause of death for almost 2,700 women in the United States in 1930. The actual number was likely higher because not all abortion-related deaths were recorded as such. After the introduction of antibiotics in the 1940s, the numbers decreased, but abortion was still a highly dangerous procedure for those who couldn't pay for them to be professionally performed. Thousands of women were admitted to hospitals yearly for abortion complications. So clearly, making abortion illegal didn't make them go away. So what was the point of making them illegal? Shaming of women who did not conform to societal expectations. Researcher Leslie J. Reagan notes that the abortion laws of the time period had the effect of exposing and humiliating women who were caught in raids on abortion clinics or were in the hospital suffering from procedure complications. Doctors and police pushed these women to give dying declarations, pressuring them to admit obtaining abortions, their marital status, the father of the unborn baby, and the name of the abortion provider. In 1902, the Journal of the American Medical Association endorsed the policy of denying a woman medical care until she confessed to having an abortion, which was common practice during this time. So much for do no harm. The prospect of being interrogated upon turning up at the hospital led many women to delay or deny themselves medical care if complications occurred, which contributed to the death rate from abortion. Abortion during the early to mid-1900s tended to rise and fall with societal conditions. Abortion was sought out more often during the Great Depression, as more Americans were encountering extreme poverty. In the 1950s, abortion was even more difficult to obtain, even through safe channels that women of means had access to due to the conservative mores of the time period. In the 1960s, some states began loosening their abortion restrictions, allowing it in cases of rape, incest, fetal defects, or danger to the physical and mental health of the woman. In 1970, New York decriminalized abortion. By 1971, maternal mortality dropped in the state by 45%. The wide variation of the laws in states regarding abortion in the early 1970s meant that for well-off women, they had the option of traveling to New York to obtain a legal abortion, but those who were not so well-off were still subject to illegal back-alley abortions in 49 out of 50 states, and this led to an estimated over 5,000 deaths per year, mostly Black and Latino women. Like a number of U.S. Supreme Court decisions ruling on controversial political issues, Roe v. Wade was a decision that was meant to solve state-by-state variations that were difficult for citizens and professionals to navigate. So this was really a pragmatic decision. And by this time, doctors were largely advocating for abortion to be legalized. So in 1973, Roe v. Wade was handed down by the U.S. Supreme Court. The court ruled that one's right to privacy included a woman's right to have an abortion, but this right to privacy was not absolute. In the first trimester, abortion was completely legal as long as it was performed by a licensed doctor. In the second trimester, states may place restrictions on abortions, and in the third trimester, states may outlaw abortion. The decision in the sister case, Doe v. Bolton, stated that abortion can be obtained up until birth to protect the woman's health. As mentioned in Episode 8's Did You Know segment, there was not widespread outrage at the Roe v. Wade decision at the time from the religious right, as abortion was not a major rallying point among clergy at the time, and many prominent conservative Protestant clergy were not opposed to abortion at this point. The outrage came later, as Republican strategists were attempting to cultivate a white conservative religious constituency. We'll pick up there in part two. Check out our website today, PotSwearerPodcast.com, for previous episodes, special presentations, announcements, merch, and all things PotSwearer Podcast. You can find our show on iTunes, Google Play, and most other podcatchers. If you enjoy the show, please subscribe, give us 5 stars, leave a review, share, and tell your friends. Thank you for listening and supporting PotStirrer Podcast. I'm Jay Poole. Let's fight for America's future, because freedom is not free.